My name's Wendy and I'm an addict. It's quite strange talking into this. Can you hear me at the back? Because I've been warned that if you can't hear me in the back, you complain. Oh, you must be able to hear me. Tell me about it afterwards. I've been coming to this fellowship now for 23 years. I've been clean 23 years. So it works. And I'm the living proof of that. When I did first come to this fellowship, I'd say I was wretched is the word I would use, wretched. I'd used for 15 years, and it's strange actually being in this area because I did a lot of using in this area. I used to use down on Piccadilly. I actually don't know where people score anymore, but we used to score down on the tube station in just by the ladies' toilet, Subway 4 it was called. And it was very, very grim. Barbiturates were rife at the time. I took an awful lot of barbiturates, and I've lost count of the times ambulances were called to that toilet to pick me up off the floor where I'd overdosed, and practically everybody else. And in recovery, I did a kind of pilgrimage back to that toilet. It's all changed now, and it looks very clean and modern, and you would never have known that there was a load of dying addicts in that place. And I kind of let go of that time, and I was very, very glad that not only had that toilet changed, but I had changed. And I had changed by coming to this fellowship. When I was using on Subway 4, I never dreamt that I would ever get clean. I didn't even think about getting clean. I thought about dying mostly, and my peer group of the time were wiped out mostly by barbs, not heroin, barbs. Because you'd take the barbs and you'd forget that you'd taken them, and you'd take another handful and another handful. So my peer group, I don't think there's any of them left standing, so I am blessed. I'll tell you a little bit about my background. I come from a big Irish family, Irish Catholic. I'm the eldest of seven children, and the addiction, the illness, the disease, whatever you want to call it, is rife in my family. My grandfather died of alcoholism. My father is 80 and he is an active alcoholic. My mother is addicted to prescription pills. I have a brother who's using, and I have two brothers who are clean and in the fellowship. So it is in the family, definitely. And an uncle. I've got an uncle also who's been in AA, I think, 40 years. Is that why I'm an addict? I haven't a clue. Is it genetic? Was it because my background was dysfunctional? I don't know. All I know is that I am an addict and I accept it. My childhood, as you can imagine, was chaotic. There was a lot of violence, a lot of anxiety, not a lot of love. And when I came into the fellowship, I was very bitter about the lack of affection, the lack of love in my family home, until I understood that my parents couldn't give me the love that I needed or wanted because they couldn't love themselves, and they hadn't had the love either. I started to learn about this addiction when I came into the into the fellowship. I left home at 15. I couldn't wait to get away, and I don't know what I thought was going to happen to me. I was sure I was going to become famous, that I'd be walking down the street and somebody would say, "That's the person we want to be famous." I mean, I'd never been to acting school or learned to sing, but that was the fantasy, that I kind of handed my life and my will over to some film producer somewhere. It didn't happen that way. I got pregnant at 16, so that put a bit of a damper on the riches and the fame. And I gave my child away. I couldn't cope. I was 17 when she was born. And it's not that I didn't love her. I just could not cope. And I don't think I actually understood that I was pregnant. I was very out of touch with my feelings. So when she arrived, it was a bit like having a doll. And I went off and left her in a foster home. I used to visit, but I went out looking for something that would fix me. A baby hadn't fixed me, and I thought it would. I thought if I had something to love and something that would love me back, that I'd be happy. But no, a baby is a dependent, and its needs are prominent, not yours. The baby needs, and it cries, and it doesn't say thank you. You know, it doesn't say, yeah, thanks, it's great. Well, not that it's maybe older, but not when it's new. And I didn't want any of that, really. I wanted somebody to give me something. I came out of hospital with no money, no plan, not even clothes for the baby, nothing. My life was totally unmanageable. And somebody told me about nightclubs and a club where you could go, and all you had to do was go and drink champagne with men, and you got paid for it. Sounds good, doesn't it? Sounds good to me. Drink champagne and people pay you money. And I thought, whoa, yeah, I'll have some of that. So I went along to this nightclub, and it was in Bond Street, and it was a very exclusive nightclub, and we had to wear long gowns, and we presented to these men, and you sat down and you had to encourage them to buy champagne. And that was fine. But what it really was, you know, a hostess club, and you're expected to sleep with the customers. And I held out for about 2 weeks and saying, no, I don't want to do that. And the other girls told me how much money they were making. And I thought, well, okay. I mean, you know, no one's going to know. No one's going to see. Keep it all a big secret. And it wasn't that hard, you know, because I'd kind of never valued myself. I'd never valued my body. Sexuality was a mystery to me. Sex was a commodity. You know, I just never valued myself. And I thought that I could actually just hand over my body to people and there would be no consequences to that. But there were. It's a very difficult thing to do. It really is. It sounds easy, but it robs a little bit of your soul every time you do it. And so after a few months, I started to feel really lousy about myself. And I didn't like what I was doing, and I couldn't stand the men. You know, they were a lot older than me, old as my grandfather, some of them. They were very rich, and they thought everything I had to say was fascinating. Well, it would be if you're 17 and very pretty. Yeah, anything you say is fascinating. So I found it harder and harder to do this job. And there was a guy in the toilet upstairs. He brushed the men's coats and, you know, looked after him in the men's cloakroom. And he sold drugs up there. And the first thing that happened to me was I couldn't sleep. And he sold mandrakes. Mandrakes are a bit like barbs, but better. So he said, take one of these and you'll be able to sleep. And I did. But I fought it. You know, I didn't just take it and go to sleep. And I liked the feeling. And I liked that feeling a lot because I disappeared. All the anxiety went. I could be free. I was freed of self-obsession. I was freed of anxiety. I was free. And I liked that feeling. And of course, I wanted more. So I used to have a regular supply of these mandrakes. But they made me very apathetic in the day, so I found speed. And that was the start of my using, speed and up and down, up and down. And I rather liked it. You know, you take Black Bomber in the morning and you're up, and take these things at night and you're down. And I didn't have to think about my life. I didn't have to think about what I was doing for a living. I didn't have to think about the daughter I'd given away. I didn't have to think about the fact that I'd left home at 15 and I missed my family, mad as they were, I missed them. I didn't have to think about anything. Those first drugs kept me using really for 15 years. One was not enough, and two was not enough, and three was not enough, and it went on and on and on. And I wanted to try other drugs, of course. The only drug I didn't try was LSD, because weirdly I was afraid of losing control. You know, I never did try LSD, because I thought, ooh, what if I lose control? But, you know, you take 10 Tunal and you certainly lose control. Big time. And it always surprises me that as a woman I could put myself in such a vulnerable position. You know, you take 10 Tunal and you are totally helpless. You know, and I was living in squats and all sorts, and anybody could do anything they wanted with me if they wished, because I was incapable of protecting myself. And that thought today horrifies me, that I, as a woman, I could just render myself helpless. I kept overdosing on the drugs, and I ended up in Tooting Bec drug unit. I don't know if anyone here remembers Tooting Bec. It was the only place, really, apart from Phoenix House, for drug addicts. And the treatment basically consisted of, are you going to stop using these drugs? And I'd say, yes. And then they'd release me out into the community. And that was the treatment for drug addicts. They hadn't a clue what to do with us. And they couldn't understand why young people would want to destroy themselves. They could understand old men who wanted to drink themselves to death. But they certainly couldn't understand why young people would want to drug themselves to death. And they struggled, basically. But Tooting Bec did keep me alive, because I was about 6.5 stone in weight, covered in acne because the poison from the amount of drugs was coming out in my skin. And I was a complete state. And I'd go into Tooting Bec and I'd recover, I suppose, for a little while and come back out and use. And I then got into heroin because I saw that everybody else was using heroin, and I thought, well, I might as well try that. I had no qualms about using needles, just went for it. And it was nice for a while. Lots of terrible things happened to me, rape, I nearly died from double pneumonia. I won't go into a great big long war story. If you use, you attract crap, basically, and I did. And the people that I had to associate with were hard-hearted people who wanted their money, and there was no... It was a tough scene. It was a tough scene, and I got involved in stuff that I'm very ashamed of today. Violence and horrible stuff. So, how did I get here? Well, mental hospitals and drug units were my sanctuary, I suppose. And I went in and out of them from the age of 18. In and out, in and out, in and out. They're called asylums for a reason, because they offer asylum. And that was the attraction for me from this drug, mad drug world. And they'd give you a maintenance script, so, you know, you had everything you needed. You had company, you had your methadone and your Ficeptone amps and stuff like that then. But it wasn't much of a life, you know, and slowly I lost everything. My family didn't want to know. The foster parents and my daughter, I couldn't go there because I was in such a state. I lost everything, all my friends. I couldn't work in the clubs anymore because I was just, you know, I wanted to hit the customers, and I did pick up bottles and all that kind of stuff because I was so angry with everything. And it's a crap job. It was a crap job. So I went into Springfield Hospital for the last time. And I must be honest, I didn't have any dreams of cleaning up. I went in there for my usual holiday, you know, my asylum. I went in and I didn't think I was going to come out clean. But a miracle happened while I was in there. I surrendered. There was a very nice lady who had a drinks group in there. And at the end of my using, I was drinking a bottle of spirits a day. And I'd stopped the barbs because I was drug epileptic and I didn't like the fits. And I didn't want to use needles anymore because I had abscesses and I was covered in all this acne. And so I stopped using drugs, in brackets, and picked up the bottle. And I picked up the bottle in the same way I picked up the drugs. I didn't stop to think about it. But I went into Springfield, and something in me surrendered. Why, I don't know. All I can say is that I was ready. I was ready to stop using. And I attended this lady's drinks group. And I was 6 months at Springfield as a day patient. And I had one drink while I was there, and I knew I was not going to stay clean and sober on my own. And I went and admitted it to this lady. And she said, would you come to an AA meeting? And I said, yes. And I went. And she worked at the hospital, this lady. She was an OT helper. And she put me at the back of the room, and she sat up in front of the meeting. She was the secretary of the meeting, and I had no idea she was a recovering alcoholic. She became my sponsor. I left Springfield, and I started to go to AA meetings. And I turned up at every meeting. I then found I needed NA. I'm going back 23 years, and they weren't particularly happy about you talking about drugs then. It's not the same now. So I went to NA, and I felt at home. I felt I'd found my home. It was where I belonged. And I did my early recovery like I did drugs. I did 2 meetings a day, and I did 4 on a Saturday. I used to leave my house at 11 o'clock in the morning, and I used to go to the Dome in Chelsea. Then I'd go to a lunchtime meeting, and I'd come back, and we'd sit in the Dome or the Chelsea Pot until the 7:30 meeting. Then we'd come out of the 7:30 meeting, and then we'd go back to the Dome or the Chelsea Pot, and then we'd go clubbing. Am I an addict or what? Yes. But I was in a safe place. And I did it like that for about 3 years. I also did the steps, worked through the steps. I had my sponsor, and I did service. And this is very important, you know, the steps. Step 1. I think it's my favorite step. Because if you don't have it in place, you know, it's like a house of cards. If that base isn't solid, then all your other steps will collapse. That has to be solid. We admitted we were powerless over our addiction. And that's got to be done on a gut level. It's not about writing out the step, you know, and, you know, I've read as a sponsor, Oscar winning step ones, and the person is still used. It's got to come from the heart. You've got to feel it. And if you do that step, you should have no problem with the rest of the steps, if you do it properly, and admitted our lives were unmanageable. And I did that. I totally surrendered. And I was willing to go to any lengths, and I mean that. If my sponsor had said, run naked down the King's Road, I kid you not, I would have done it. I did not want to use. I did not want to go back to that hell. No hope out there when you're using. You know, and everybody you see is hopeless as well. You know, our grey faces and our haunted eyes. I didn't want to see that anymore. And, you know, your heart shut down and you can't laugh and you can't cry. Who wants to go back to that? So I was willing to go to any lengths. And I every suggestion that my sponsor gave me, I followed it. And I really wanted to do service. You know, my first service commitment was office duty. You only need to be 6 months clean to do office duty. And it's a wonderful, wonderful piece of service. Because you get to hear the damage that it does to not just the addict, but the families of the addicts. I remember doing office duty, and a lady rang up, and she said, hello, is that Narcotics Anonymous? And I said, yes, it is. And she said, I want you to come and get my son. He just robbed me again. He's taken my purse and all my rent money. Can you come and get him? And she was sobbing on the phone. And NA doesn't do that. We don't come and get people. People have to be willing to come to a meeting. And I tried to explain this to this poor lady. I said, you know, we don't do that. Can you get your son to ring us? She said, he won't. He doesn't want to stop. And I said, well, there is an organisation called FA. She said, well, I don't want to hear about that. Come and get him. And for the first time, I realised what my own family must have gone through, what my own mother must have, coming up to Tooting Beck, standing outside, you know, Tooting Beck, and she got mugged on the way home. What my own mother went through, I heard it when I did that service. So office duty is a fantastic piece of service to do. And it's lovely to actually, you know, turn up somewhere. You've talked to somebody on the phone and they're desperate. You turn up at a station to meet them. And you never forget that. And they never forget you, because you're their first, you know, face of NA, if you like. And I went on from office duty to do lots of H&I. That's my favourite service as well. I've done it all. But H&I, because I spent so many years in institutions, I chose to do that. And I've done lots of service in prisons. I think I was one of the first people ever to go into Wandsworth Prison. And we've been very, very successful in Wandsworth Prison. They've got their own clean wing now. They didn't want us in there in the beginning. They were very suspicious. And we had this long lecture when we first went in there. They had, some weeks they thought we were a bit like the Sally Army and hadn't a clue about addiction. And other weeks they thought we were trying to smuggle something in and that we weren't to be trusted. So we had this long lecture and they'd show us toothbrushes and say, this is what they've made, and they stab each other with this and you don't know what you're dealing with. And we said, well, you know, but we are addicts. And it was a compliment, really, that they couldn't actually imagine us being... They scared the life out of us. And I went up to Wandsworth Prison. I thought, oh, my God, what's going to happen? We'll be stabbed in the middle of the meeting or something. Of course, it was just another meeting, and it was fabulous. I remember when we used to do the AIDS wing, and all the people with HIV and AIDS were segregated then. And those were fantastically powerful meetings, because sometimes those guys, their families didn't even know, and there was a lot of fear. Wonderful meetings, and I feel very privileged to have been part of that. And we did the segregated wing, and as the face of NA, I have no judgments. Every addict deserves to hear the message, no matter what they've done. And going up on, you know, Rule 43 was a wonderful experience, and it opened my mind to, you know, other things, and I saw other things. And if we carry the message, every addict has to hear the message, you know, without prejudice. And I was able to do that, and I feel proud of that. I also sponsored a girl who was doing life for murder, and she was incarcerated in Cookham Wood. And that was a wonderful privilege. She's out now. And I could imagine myself, she'd killed somebody in a blackout, and I could imagine myself doing that, especially certain boyfriends. I could definitely imagine myself doing it, so I could relate. And again, once we take those drugs, we don't know what the consequences are going to be. We don't know if we're going to end up in a prison. We don't know what is going to happen. So it was a great reminder of what can happen. My recovery hasn't all been plain sailing, I'll say. I have hepatitis C, and I got very sick when I was about 3 years clean. Some people with hepatitis C never get ill, and good luck to them. Some people clear it with interferon, and great. But I'm not one of those people. I've unfortunately been very, very sick with hepatitis C, and I now have cirrhosis of the liver. I did try interferon, and it all went drastically wrong, and I became allergic to the 20th century, and I couldn't sit under a light bulb, truly. I couldn't eat, I couldn't do anything, and it was very scary because nobody could relate to it, and they thought I'd gone mad. You know, medical profession, I couldn't eat, so they were going to drip feed me, and that was very scary. And because I was allergic to newsprint and stuff like that, I couldn't read anything apart from the big book and the 12 steps. I think we might have gone out again, but don't worry, I'll project. But I had the 12 steps, and I had the big book. And you know what? They kept me clean. I didn't need anything else. This program works. It works. And all you need is the willingness. All you need is the 12 steps and this program. It is perfect. I'm not saying every meeting isn't. We're human and we mess up. But the program itself, it's a privilege to have it in my life. It really is. I've had a lot of fun in the fellowship as well. I've joined every committee, and one of the most amazing was the entertainments committee, and we put on wonderful parties, and I've been involved in lots of crazy stunts, or, you know, I joined a group and we lip-sync the Weather Girls, It's Raining Men, and there was two of us dressed up in wigs, and God knows, one of them was a man, as the Weather Girls, and we were dressed up, and three guys came on dressed in leather, and it was great fun, and I can't do that now, because my health wouldn't allow me to, but I'm so glad I did it. So my message is, I suppose, if you've got anything you want to do, do it. You know, when I look around this room, you know, and I think somebody mentioned that this, after this meeting, people will be cooking for homeless people. You know, that brings me right back to what it was like when I was using. I remember being in Greek Street Women's Hospital, hostel. I don't know if anyone's had the privilege of being in there, but it's grim. It's really grim, and not a lot of hope. There's a lot of people with mental problems, and that's where I ended up. And I think about my life today. I think about the good friends I have. I think about the lovely people in my life. I think about all the help I've been given, about all the joy I've been given. And, you know, I am very, very grateful for this fellowship. But the most wonderful thing is, today I feel I deserve it. You know, all this good stuff that comes along, I feel I deserve it. When I was using, I just felt I deserved to die. You know, I thought I'm such a rotten person. You know, how can anyone love me? I'm just horrible. I'm hateful. And the shame for what I'd done. You know, but today, I know I'm lovable. I know I'm capable of loving. I've been reunited with my daughter. I'm a grandmother. I have a baby granddaughter. That's not been easy. As you can imagine, my child wants to know, why did you give me away? And explaining about addiction and the compulsion to use is very difficult, because only an addict understands the obsession to use, that you will put anything in front of your, you know, drugs come first. And you will find the means, the ways to get those drugs. And we have to be cunning and somehow powerful in a way, because I never went without my drugs in the end. I found a way to get my drugs. And trying to explain that to somebody who is not an addict is difficult. But we're trying. We're trying. And that's one of the joys of recovery. Higher power. I'll talk a bit about higher power. When I first came into the fellowship, I didn't really want to hear about higher power. My background is Irish Catholic. You know, lots of guilt, lots of shame, lots of do this, do that. I didn't want to hear about that. So I had a bit of difficulty when I first came in with a higher power. But higher power is not about God. It's God as you understand it. You know, if the rooms are your higher power, fine. You know, whatever. And I've gone down lots of spiritual paths in recovery. And I think it's good if we look for our higher power. To do a step 11, you know, to have that conscious contact with the higher power, to hand it over, truly. I think we have to look for that higher power. And I have looked in many, many places. I went back to the Catholic Church and I spent 4 years there, and it was great fun. I went to Lourdes because I wanted to be cured of Hep C. It was a selfish motive, but it was a wonderful experience, and I'm going to go again this year. You know, I saw a microcosm of the world there. You know, I saw Bosnian peasants begging, you know, for a home, I suppose, or for the end of the war or whatever. I saw groups of Africans in turbans going up and doing the Stations of the Cross. It was fantastic. It was a wonderful experience. I don't know if I'm a believing God or Jesus, but the spiritual feeling was there. And it's in these rooms. I felt it when I came back. That same vibe is in these rooms, because we all have that common purpose. We want to carry the message. We want to stay clean and carry a message. And that is spiritual. So if you're in this room, you are a spiritual person. As I've also tried Buddhism. I went out to a Buddhist retreat and I've chanted and I've done all sorts of things. And that was equally wonderful. And the philosophies basically are all the same. But I suppose what I'm trying to say is find a spiritual path, one that suits you. You know, at 4 o'clock in the morning, when your heart is just wretched, when you're lost, when you can't phone anyone, when you need something, when you need some comfort, when you need to reach out, that higher power will be there for you. But you must connect. You must have that contact. How do you get that contact? You be still. Whether that's praying, meditating, chanting, whatever. Just opening the text. You must be still to have a conscious contact with a higher power. And if you can manage just 1 minute, then you're doing it. You're doing it. And step three, you know, handing your life over to the care of God. Just do it. Doesn't matter. I don't know what God is or what the higher power is. I can't see it. I can't frame it. I don't know. But I know I feel it. That's all I know about the higher power, is that I feel it inside of me. And it's a nice feeling. And it's pure. You know, and I can rely on it. As human beings, we're fallible. I'm fallible. I mess up all the time. I make mistakes. And just because I'm 23 years clean doesn't mean I've turned into some sort of saint. No. Get me on a bad day and you'll see how grumpy I can be, how self-obsessed, how addict I can be. You know, so it's not a path to sainthood. But I am less self-obsessed. I am more patient. I am more tolerant. I am more understanding. I do love more. I do cry more. And I do laugh more. And isn't that a blessing? You know, I hadn't cried or laughed for so long when I came into the fellowship. And I think of my first year and how much I laughed. At nothing, really. Just laughed and laughed, and how freeing that was. And everybody in this room deserves to laugh. You know, life is difficult. And we deserve the freedom to laugh and to cry. And I'll say this about crying. Embrace it. That's how you heal. There's nothing wrong. If you are in the middle of the night on your knees crying, that's a good bloody thing, I promise you. Because you are healing. You're in the process of healing. If you're not crying, then maybe something is wrong. If you're laughing, that's healing. And for every person that walks in this door, I hold out my hand because I so desperately needed someone to hold out their hand to me. And I remember every face that said hello to me. I remember every person that gave me a lift to a meeting or bought me a coffee or said, have a meal. You know, I remember them. Some of them are dead now. You know, not everybody stayed clean. And I think of the wonderful people, you know, that I knew that died of this illness. And also I see the people that use sometimes. I'm thinking of one particular person who did years of service, who was a very nice guy and wonderful. I saw him recently and he was sitting at a bus stop. And he's been using for quite a few years now. And his eyes were dead and he looked 20 years older and he was lost. And I could hardly believe it was the same person. And he was unhappy and he saw me and he looked ashamed. He thought I would judge him, I suppose, which I wouldn't do. You know, I wanted to reach out, but his body language said, go away, don't talk to me. And I respect that because that's how I was when I was using. But it's a terrible shame what happens to us when we do use. You know, our very being disappears and this empty, cold person inhabits us. And it's not the real us. The real us is the one that is sitting in this room. I mean, I feel it's a great privilege to be able to do a chair here. You know, this reminds me of a meeting I used to go to, Paddington. I think it was a mental unit, and it was a huge meeting, and we used to have a guy who used to come down in his pajamas. And I don't think he knew what the hell was going on, but he used to walk up and down and join in and, you know, he'd say the Serenity Prayer and God love him, I suppose it helped him. And but I have nice memories of that meeting. It was real front line and it was just perfect for me when I came in. Well, I hope what I've said has made a bit of sense, and, you know, I hope in 23 years' time, you know, another 23 years' time, I'll still be doing chairs because I went to the 50 years of AA, and there were people of 80 doing shares, you know, and I want to be 80 and doing a share. Anyway, I'll leave it there. Thank you.